This is the Biblical Studies lecture on the Old Testament for the Diaconate Studies of the Home Temple Priesthood. People tend to think of the Bible as written in stone, written by God. It's all a monolithic document that is totally sacred and it has come down through history. Well, that's the way it's been portrayed ever since the rise of Protestant tradition, when the Protestants substituted biblical authority for the authority of the popes and the bishops and the councils of the Catholic Church and so on. But in fact, this attitude towards Scripture is not a really ancient attitude. Scripture is a collection of many different kinds of writing by many different people in many different conditions for different purposes. And it was known and understood as such until the time of the Protestant Revolution, when Protestants needed some way to show authority for their ideas and their ideals, because the Roman Catholic Church, which controlled Europe at that time, and the papacy, claimed their authority in apostolic succession, in the laying down of generation upon generation, hands upon head from the Master Jesus, that they carried the episcopal authority, and therefore what the decisions that were made from within the church and the church hierarchy were inspired by God. And very few people could read a Bible. The Bible was in Latin, which was not its original tongue. It was translated into Latin, both the Old Testament and New Testament, by St. Jerome in the 4th, 5th century, and it became the Vulgate Bible. And it was able to be read and accessible only to scholars and to a very few clergy, because most clergy were not trained to read. And so the only way these stories were transmitted is orally or through little dramas and plays that were done at cathedrals and things like that. And the Protestants were of the heretical movement that wanted to rethink Christianity and the origins of Christianity by going back to the literature of the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so the Bible became their holy and sacred authority, just as the Pope had been in earlier times, or the bishops and the apostolic authority of the episcopal synods and so on. So that's where we get our idea that the Bible was written by God and it's written in stone. In fact, there are many scriptures for many different religions and traditions that are held to be as sacred as the Christian or Jewish scriptures, and they are treated with much of the same respect. The Greeks, in the time of Jesus and earlier, regarded the epics of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, to be sacred and inspired literature, which they interpreted allegorically, not literally. And many other collections of literature, legends and stories of the origins of the world and the origins of the nation and so on, have survived as scriptures. The word dictated by Muhammad survived as a Quran, which became that holy scripture. But actually the Jews were the first people, the Hebrews, but actually after the historical period in which we would start calling them Jews rather than Hebrews, were the first people who had a religion of the book, because they were exiled from their own land. After the rebellions of the first and second century, the Jews became a wandering people, the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews into all different lands, necessitated some way of carrying tradition, and so it was carried in Scripture. Now, where did the Bible come from? Where did our Bibles come from? Well, from that period of time in history, Bibles were being put together in Jewish tradition, and from a few centuries earlier. There was no Bible in the 8th century before the Christian era, or the 6th century before the Christian era. There were simply different writings of different schools of prophets. There were court chronicles that were kept in the courts of the two nations, Israel and Judah, of which Israel disappeared a century earlier than Judah because it was overrun by the Assyrians, and then the nation of Judah was eventually taken captive by the Babylonians, and until the Babylonian captivity ended, and Ezra and Nehemiah were able to reestablish a colony at the site of Jerusalem and to start rebuilding the walls and the other accoutrements of the temple, there was no real Bible of any sort. It was at that time that in Hebrew history, what we will now start calling Jewish history, or what is called the time of the Second Temple, from the 5th century and 4th century before the Christian era, on down through the time of the Master Jesus, those centuries, that what we know of as the Old Testament was compiled. And it was compiled by people who were the priests or the religious authorities of Judaism, the scribes, the priests, the people who were of the nobility, who could read, and who had been in the older courts and who wanted to maintain their continuity and their tradition, begin to assemble the literature that came through Judaism. And by that time, the tremendous split between what we call monarchical Judaism, that is the Hebrew religion of the political courts of both Judah and Israel, the two ancient countries that the original Israel of David and Solomon split into in the 9th century. Those two nations, Israel and Judah, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, those two nations each had their own prophets and their own court chronicles, and in fact their own ways of naming God. In one tradition, God was known as Yahweh, or perhaps not pronounced Yahweh, but written as Yahweh, as YHWH, the sacred tetragrammaton. In the other tradition, God was known as Elohim, a very unusual word because the Semitic word for God is El, and Elohim is the plural. It literally means gods. And these two traditions, the Yahwist tradition and the Elohist tradition, permeates the writings of the Old Testament because they've been put together, both of those traditions, after the time of the exile and the return from exile. All the literature that these people could get a hold of from either kingdom was brought together as sacred literature, and so we have Yahwist literature and we have Elohist literature. So we have God called Yahweh in certain streams of the literature, and other streams he's called Elohim. And we'll talk about that later when we talk about the source theory of the Old Testament. So at this time in the 4th century, 5th century, before the Christian era, we have the beginnings of the making of a Bible. And what goes into that Bible? Poetry, traditions that are used at weddings, the psalms, which are sung in temple and in other places and in religious groups, the writings of various schools of the prophets, some of the oldest writings of the prophets, perhaps from Amos, were originally written down on pottery or potsherds. Later they were collected, perhaps at Bethel, and kept by family or by members of his school, because the prophets were all very powerful teachers and they had students, just like Socrates had students. And these prophetic schools, or sometimes even guilds, kept this information. You have to understand that the courts, the political powers of both Israel and Judah, and the prophetic movement, which was a movement of people, individuals, and communities that were separated from the political mainstream and who were anti-establishment. The two streams of religion, the prophetic religion, which hearkened back to Moses and the laws of Moses, and did not approve of what the kings were doing by taking censuses and by setting up big temples and worshiping God in the same manner that the other kingdoms round about in the Middle East were worshiping their gods and making their temples. All this sort of split between prophetic tradition and monarchical tradition, the tradition of the monarchs, came together and was brought together a bit before the final fall of Judah in the 6th century, before the Christian era. There was a great reform. And at that time, the families of prophets became members of the priesthood. They became members of the royal families, so to speak. And that is where we get prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and so on. And it is at this time that a book is discovered, supposedly written by Moses in one of the rooms of the temple. And of course, it's not written by Moses. It describes his death and does all kinds of things about him. It is probably written by one of the prophetic schools. And that book is a book we know now as Deuteronomy. And that book was considered to be the basis for a great reform in religion that brought together all the different factions in Israel into what we call Deuteronomic religion. And that impulse continued through the time of the exile, and when the post-exilic leaders like Ezra and Nehemiah came back and started collecting all the literature they could to preserve their traditions and try to reestablish a religious Israel rather than a political Israel, beginning of a kind of Hasidic politics, then they brought together streams from the prophetic, from the northern, from the southern, and all this was brought together into the first five books of what we call the Old Testament, which we know as the Pentateuch: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers. And those five books, which are known as the Pentateuch, and sometimes a sixth is added, and it's known as the Hexateuch, are actually the first Bible. And just that Bible itself, just that itself, was all that was considered to be holy by the Samaritans. And there are still Samaritans existing. At least there were 20 years ago in Israel, I think about 200 of them. But the leader of the Samaritans and his family had inbred so much that the inheritor of the tradition was probably not mentally fit to assume that role. And when I was in theological seminary 30 years ago, at that time it was thought that the Samaritan dynasty was just about to become extinct. But these five books formed a core, and to these books were added and collected many others. This was known as the Torah. These five books were the Torah, the law. And that was the basis for Jewish law and the decisions that were made by the rabbinical interpreters, where these older laws, most of them applying to a wandering later, the Deuteronomic things are clearly a settled agricultural kind of community, but many of the laws are laws that are brought down from ancient times when we have wandering tribes, and they're like martial law. They're very militant and they're very difficult. And so the rabbinic interpreters later on use these laws as a basis for extending them into other things that would deal with other situations to make decisions about what the community should do in those situations. And this was the beginning of Jewish legal tradition and the tradition that came out through the eventually through the rabbis. Now, there was another stream besides the law, the Torah, and what we will call the the Psalms and Proverbs and other kinds of writings, which were handed down through many different channels. There were the court chronicles, like Kings, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and so on, that survived from the two different ancient monarchies that had existed. And some of the chronicles that tell the same story in different modality are rather antagonistic, as we read them, towards King David. And it's clear from things like this and other kinds of internal evidence where these records came from and what the biases of the authors and the politics of the country were that were dealing with these things. Then there is another stream of writings that come from the schools of the prophets, many different prophets. Now, the prophets that have their names on these books did not sit down and write these books in some room somewhere and then hand them out. They were the teachings of the prophets as taken down, perhaps as delivered orally and taken down by their students. In the book of Isaiah, we have Isaiah and Deutero-Isaiah and Trito-Isaiah. We have three different histories and times of the Isaian school that we can separate in the book of Isaiah that are very clearly different and so on. So the prophetic literature is literature of prophetic schools, mystic schools within Judaism. The school of Isaiah, very, very different from the ancient times of Moses. In the ancient times of Moses, was not able to see the face of God. In fact, we're told in the story that when God appears on the mountain to Moses, that Moses can only glimpse, and I'm quoting from the King James, the hinder parts of God. It's if he were to look upon God fully, he would be absolutely incinerated. No one could look upon God and live. That's why in the older traditions, the Ark of the Covenant is being carried and starts to fall, and someone runs up to try to stop it from falling and is immediately killed by the power of God because of the power of the holiness of the Ark is so much that humans can't handle it. It's not because God is being mean. But at the time of Isaiah, perhaps 600 years after this period in Israel's history when we have Moses and the Ark and all this sort of thing, we have a very different story. We have Isaiah who ascends to the throne of God. He goes in deep vision to the throne of God and he sees God as the Ancient of Days sitting upon a throne, and his lips are purified by a hot coal, by an angel, and so on, and he's given a message. He has a vision of God. He ascends to the throne of God and sees God. Now, is that because Isaiah was a better man than Moses? No, it's because religion in the time of Isaiah was very different, and the experience of the divine and the experience of God was very different at that time. Well, the Old Testament preserves for us in its many, many parts, which, because the literature of the Old Testament, I should say, covers a period of about 1,000 years of growth and development in the Hebrew religious tradition and experience, about 1,000 years of evolution of thought and experience of God and Godhead. And that example I've given you of Moses, who would have been struck dead if he looked at God, and Isaiah, who ascends to God's throne, and is the beginning of what we call the Merkabah mysticism, throne mysticism, the mystical practices of the pure ones, where they ascend to the throne of God and have visions, etc. And there are all kinds of rules about this in the few centuries before the time of the Master Jesus, and it's reflected even in Paul, who tells us that he was taken up to the third heaven, and so on. These Merkabah mystic traditions, throne mysticism, throne chariot mysticism, come through prophetic religion and become part of wisdom tradition and proto-rabbinic tradition, mysticism in Israel, of a sort that Jesus is clearly immersed in through his experiences on the mountain at nighttime of being in communion with and conversation with the great saints of Judaism and so on. So we have in the Old Testament a bunch of literature that covers everything from the earliest legends and songs of Israel to the proverbs that were transmitted through Israel, which came before Israel in Egypt and in Edom. You can find maybe 30%, almost word for word, of what's in the Old Testament as proverbs. You can find as Egyptian proverbs, 1,000 years before the time of the Hebrew Old Testament. Or you can find them as Edomite wisdom sayings. And you can find many other things that are brought through these traditions. Not the least of which are the stories of Moses being put in a basket, which are taken from the stories of King Sargon 2,000 years before that. And of course, the creation story in Genesis, which is modeled upon the Babylonian creation story, in which the same thing takes place in the Jewish story that takes place in the Babylonian story on the first day, and the second day, the third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, when human beings are made, and the seventh day when there's a rest, and so on. So the Hebrew Old Testament is a very complex study of ancient literature, and it comes and has roots in many different parts of the ancient Near East, and it's assembled together into this conglomerate thing that we call the Torah. After the return of the exiles from Babylon, from the Babylonian captivity, and it grows after that, and to that are added even more prophets, like the prophet Daniel. And finally, the production of sacred literature goes on and on. We have the Enoch literature and all what we call the intertestamental apocrypha into pseudepigrapha, etc. And finally, because there was so much sacred literature, and you can verify this by looking in some of the books of the New Testament that talk about what some of the sacred stories were for the Christians. The book of Jude and some of the other places quote from their scripture, which is not our scripture. They're quoting from the book of Enoch. They're quoting from the book of Jubilees. And they're quoting from books we never heard of before. All this literature was produced, and after the destruction of the temple in the Christian era in AD 70 and so on, after this time of that Vespasian sacked the temple and allowed the head rabbi of Jerusalem to escape and go to a city with his disciples, a city called Jamnia, and establish Judaism no longer as a political threat, but as merely a religious mystery school so that they could continue their traditions. When that occurred, the rabbis sat down at Jamnia and they said, "We have to define what our Bible is because we're going to become a people of the book. We're going to become a wandering people. We're going to become no longer a people with a temple, no longer a people with a king, but a people with a book." And so they sat down and they defined the canon of the Old Testament. And they said, "We'll keep this, we'll throw this out, we'll take this, we'll throw this out." And they cut out a lot of literature. A lot of that literature is available in the paperback publication I suggest you get called The Other Bible, the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha of the Old Testament. The Roman Catholic Bible still technically carries or publishes parts of the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, but does not consider them to be inspired. The early Christians did the same thing. There was a production of literature in the first and second centuries, not just by Paul, but by people following Paul. There were many gospels, and there were many epistles, and many other kinds of productions. And when finally, in the fourth century, when the highly persecuted religion of Christianity, which was just another cult of the Roman Empire, was suddenly exalted to the religion of the land by the circumstances that led to the Council of Nicaea and so on, the circumstances which I will tell you about in a moment. At that point, the Christians had to define what their Bible was and what their Old Testament was as well as their New Testament, because the different churches had different Bibles. They had different canons, different groups of things that they had collected. Many things that were in the New Testament back then that are wonderful writings, like the Shepherd of Hermas and the Didache of the 12 apostles and many of the other wonderful things. These things are no longer in the New Testament or even in any kind of collection held by any Christian churches. You have to find them in New Testament Apocrypha and other kinds of literature. And again, the other Bible contains a lot of that literature for you to look at, and some of it is very beautiful and wonderful literature to read. When that happened, then it was decided that there would be four Gospels. That's a decision that had actually happened earlier, at the time of Tertullian. And that there would be the epistles of Paul and a few other things that they decided were authentic. And the rest of it was dropped. And so then we got the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament was pretty much defined first by the rabbis and then by the Christians. And the New Testament, of course, by the Christians. Now, one of the most important political considerations going on at this time was that the early Christians, of course, were Jews. And as Christianity spread among the Gentiles and the Greek-speaking people, who had a whole different way of looking at religion, religious experience, and were more interested in the person of Jesus as the Christ than in the teachings that he gave, and wanted to see him and cast him in the image of a Greek god, and came up with the idea of Christ and Christhood, which is an absolutely beautiful achievement, because it is a wonderful idea. But it is not what Messiahhood is. And they, of course, confused their idea of the Christ, which was like that of an avatar, or a Gnostic avatar, with the Jewish idea of the Messiah, which is a very different idea. And as a result, the Gentile Christians, who very quickly outnumbered the old Jewish Christians, who really knew the traditions and the teachings in their own language, began to see increasingly the Jewish Christians as heretics, or as eccentrics, or as off-center. And Jewish Christians, many of them, did not accept Gentiles into their Messianic fellowship. And as a result, the early Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians separated very quickly, and the Jewish Christians went and lived other places, and they actually contributed a great deal to the beginnings of Islam. And they were Gnostic, and they also survived in other traditions, John the Baptist's disciples, etc., as the Mandeans and so on, which still survive today. And so this tremendous competition that developed between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians became an anti-Semitism in the Christian church and Gentile Christianity. And as a result of that bias, and as a result of the bias in general that all Judaism had against Messianic Judaism, and thus Christianity, and the persecution of the Christians by the Jews, and of the Jews by the Christians, it got to be that a whole body of sacred literature that really should have been still part of the Bible today, because it was part of the Bibles in those days for both the Christians and the Jews, was excluded from their canons. The Jews excluded the intertestamental, what we call the intertestamental literature, the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha of the Old Testament that was done in the period of the Second Temple, because it sounded too Christian. In something like, for example, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, written about 200 years before the time of the Master Jesus, you will find perhaps 50-60% of the content of the Sermon on the Mount. Many of the exact same phrases that we find in the Sermon on the Mount. You will find so many of the teachings of Jesus, the idea of the fatherhood of God and all kinds of other things in that literature, because Jesus didn't emerge from a vacuum. He was as much a product of his times as you and I are of our times, and of divine inspiration. So what happened is the Jews excluded from their canon of scripture things that sounded too Christian, or too messianic, too much like this new movement that had come about. And the Christians, by the same token, excluded things that sounded too Jewish or Jewish mystical, which meant Gnostical. And so the Jewish and the Christian canons of scripture became the Old and the New Testament to the Christians, or just the Ancient Testament to the Jews, and developed the characters that we know of them as having today, the books that they're composed of, etc. A great deal was lost because everything that sounded too Jewish to the Christians and too Christian to the Jews was just left out. So, one of the things I would encourage you to do is to read through some of the great literature and great scripture of the era that was left out of the Bible, because it was certainly considered to be very valid by Jesus and by his followers, and it was considered to be divine and inspired scripture. But what is scripture? Scripture is not something written on stone that's taken off of a mountain. It's something that's given by inspired people who write it and who speak it, usually prophets. It's also records of events, of events in which God acts, so to speak, in history. It's also the record of a people, the Jewish people, and what happens to them and how they interpret their triumphs and their losses.